an evolution and of all its contradictions, and particularly that most important component of all history, the history of resistance to oppression and human degradation, and the fundamental instinct for freedom and for survival. The struggles of any one generation, however unremarkable they may seem, both create the space in which succeeding generations may struggle within a growing culture of resistance and enhance the human potential of those who inherit the world and the history their forebears would have made. A critical understanding of that history and of the contemporary forces that combine in the pursuit of barbarism and in the day-to-day brutalization of the human spirit is fundamental if we are to engage in purposeful action in the cause of human liberation. That, for me, was the significance of the autobiography of Malcolm X when I read it as a young person trying to make sense of the world about me, and it remains equally significant as I return to it today. I do not think that this point could be emphasized too strongly, because for me, as an educationalist and as a parent, the question of education and providing young people with tools for understanding and for self-scrutiny is paramount. And if we do not facilitate individuals and groups to locate themselves historically and to know where they stand on the important questions of the day, then we cannot sensibly speak of self-determination as a people. What are those issues? The issue of class, the issue of race, the issue of taking responsibility for the environment and for the quality of what we impose on major parts of the world's population now, and what we would bequeath to those coming after us. The issue of poverty and human degradation in the face of affluence and vulgar opulence. The issue of imperialist hegemony and the subjugation of peoples all over the world, east and west, north and south. The issue of the systemic, institutionalized, and systematic subjugation and oppression of women. The issue of work and the assumed worthlessness and lack of dignity of those whose labor is not deemed to be needed, and more importantly, of those who consciously render themselves redundant in the labor market by refusing to do shit work. In Britain, no less than in the Caribbean, in Africa, or right here in the inner cities of the United States, Malcolm spoke more directly to that latter group than to most others. He spoke to people who felt deep down in their bellies that they had nothing and therefore had nothing to lose. People who had long since ceased to believe, Christian upbringing or not, Protestant ethic or not, that crime had anything to do with morality, but saw what others called crime as a matter of options and a question of choice. In Britain, many of that generation and of the generation before them misread Malcolm and saw the situation solely in terms of black and white. An undifferentiated mass of blacks, all presumably with the same interests and the same burning commitment to black liberation and human liberation and self-determination, and a similarly undifferentiated mass of whites, all equally racist, so genetically racist to be beyond redemption, and all having an equal share in the spoils of racist exploitation, colonialism, and imperialism. The black blood-sucking capitalist paying subsistence wages to black women to work in his sweatshop while enjoying the public glory of representing blacks on the municipal council was supposed to be a more natural ally in our struggle to the black woman bringing up 5 kids on the £1.50 per hour wage that he gave her for her efforts, a better ally, a more natural ally, than the white woman next door on her housing estate who took care of her kids so that that mother wouldn't have to pay £35 a week that she did not have to a childminder and then starve. The notion of black people as a class acting in and for itself is historically, in my view, a recipe for the continued exploitation and degradation of the black working class and a hijacking of its social and cultural creativity and its soul in the interest of capital and of unbounded profit. And the fact that it is blacks doing it doesn't make it any more acceptable than it is when it is whites doing it. The question, therefore, of who is the class becomes for us a very important one, as indeed is the question of whether our liberation can take place in isolation from the liberations of oppressed peoples all over the world. We had a time in Britain when the left was telling us as black people and telling everybody else that the revolution would come via the mass activities of the organized labor movement in the Transport and General Workers Union and the heavy and powerful unions like the National Union of Mine Workers, the Printing Union, and so on. And as international capital reorganized itself and the microchip revolution dawned, with the dock workers being made redundant in droves through containerization, with the print workers being sent home in the hundreds because the printing that was needed now with 20 people no longer had use for the 500 who did the same task before, and with the mechanization in the mines, the power of the printing workers union, the dock workers, and the miners was curtailed, and the labor movement did not know how to deal with that. It took a long time, therefore, for those mainly white and mainly male people running those unions, presenting us with that view of the millennium and of utopia, to understand that the class could no more be defined in those narrow terms. A place that had to be found for and given to the women's movement, the ecological movement, movements around the need for housing within communities, resisting the police on the streets, and so on. And all of those movements had to constitute the class. We, the people of the African diaspora, who were forced to establish an identity as African Caribbean people and to witness the annihilation of the indigenous peoples of that region, the Caribbean, have a history that is inextricably linked with that of the British white working class. The struggles that they waged for the 8-hour working day, the 40-hour working week, against the ravages of child labor, for better and more sanitary working conditions, for the right to join a union and protect your interests within it, for the right of women to vote, all those struggles created space in which, as workers relocated from the plantation economies of the Caribbean to the industrial centers of Europe, we could continue to indulge the long tradition of resistance and rebellion that characterized our lives in the Caribbean and elsewhere. At a time when the British education system was misleading and failing to educate black children and would not so much as dream of employing black teachers, it was white progressive teachers who alerted us as blacks to what was happening in those schools. We checked it out. We began formulating our own demands, and in so doing, we empowered both the black school students themselves and those progressive white teachers who were seeking to challenge the racist arrangements, practices, and curriculum that constituted state education for the black child. As a body of former colonial people, education and self-development through schooling were considered to be the essential route to the escape from mediocrity, marginalization, and denial of self and of self-respect in British society. We had a battle on our hands, and we still do now after 45 years of settling in British society, a battle to reclaim and reshape state education in order to make it serve the interests of ordinary working people, black and white, rather than being a system for creating, regulating, and controlling the supply of cheap labor, miseducated, uninformed, and untrained. We have built over the last 25 years in Britain, since the mid-60s, a solid black working class education movement that continues to serve as a challenge and as a corrective to the educational underachievement of British-born black students. The transformation of the economy and the reconstitution of the working class in Britain and across continental Europe have made our task even more urgent. So particularly has the prospect of a single European identity and a single European economy after 1992. The issues of education in relation to the national economy and its purposes. The impact of the technological revolution based on the microchip. The impact of that on the international supply and quality of labor. The issue of the nation state and the movement of workers internationally across national boundaries, all of those are fundamental issues of human rights. The denial of a decent education to workers and their children, the insistence that they buttress the economy of the various nation states of Europe when capital demands, only to be booted out when the state decides, or to be denied the right to vote, to decent housing, to a part in the political process, and most important of all, the right to live, all of these constitute the most fundamental violation of the human rights of blacks from the former European colonies, of Turks, of Moroccans, of people from the Maghreb, of people from the Ivory Coast, from Liberia, from Tunisia, from the Philippines, as well as Poles, Finns, Yugoslavs, Cypriots, and numerous others in continental Europe. In Britain and in many other parts of Europe, black settlers and their European children, French, German, British, Dutch, are projected as being at the heart of the crisis. Listening to commentators and to politicians, you would believe that we caused the crisis of capitalism in Europe. The children of the immigrant generation of the settlers are refusing point blank to acquiesce in the reconstitution of themselves as a colonial labor force to be exploited in the same ways and for the same purposes as their forebears had been in their countries of origin, and continued to be later in the European centers to which they had migrated. That refusal to be controlled through the discipline of work and of the boundaries set by the state and its hypocritical value systems places that generation in head-on confrontation with the apparatuses of the state, official and unofficial. The official ones are the teachers, the police, the social workers, the courts, and the prisons, and for far too many, finally, the undertakers. The unofficial ones are the racists and fascists who engage in murderous attacks on blacks and foreigners, maiming, violating the person, violating people's homes and the places of worship with impunity, and murdering with impunity. The fact that the state never seems to manage to bring them to justice, and certainly never outlaws their activities, means that they operate within a culture in which they are seen as unofficially doing the things the state endorses and condones, and acting as the defenders of the silent majority, whose levels of tolerance are considered to have been stretched to the limit by the presence of us blacks. The official and unofficial merge in our experience, if not in the national consciousness, because the number of deaths at the hands of the police on the streets in France, Germany, and Britain, or in police custody, in detention centers, in prisons, in mental hospitals, the number of those deaths equal, if not surpass, the number of deaths at the hands of racists and fascists who kill people on the streets, throw firebombs into their homes, and incinerate them in their beds. In the hall outside, at the New Beacon Book Stall, there is on display a book entitled Murder in the Playground. It is the report of an investigation into the murder by stabbing of a 13-year-old Bangladeshi student by a 13-year-old white student in the playground of a large school in Manchester in Northwest England. I recommend it to you because it is about much more than the senseless denial of life to that courageous young martyr who refused to sit by and allow 11-year-old black students to be humiliated and robbed of dignity simply because they were black. He challenged the racist who felt it was an affront to have his white power undermined by a stupid packy, as he called him. The white boy pledged the evening before to kill Ahmed Ullah, and he brought a knife to school the following day, and within minutes of them both getting to school that morning, Ahmed Ullah was dead with fatal stab wounds in his stomach. The book is about more than that. It is about the culture of racism in British society. It is about the incorporation of blacks into the oppressive apparatuses of the state. It is about the militancy of black youth in the face of murderous oppression. It is about anti-racist liberals and the bankruptcy of the project. It is about the urgent need to democratize schooling and to share power with students and guarantee a safe environment for students to learn and for teachers to teach. Above all, it is about human rights. And let me end by saying something about human rights. I am always amazed when people like Margaret Thatcher, hanging on desperately to the shirt tails of either Reagan or Bush or whoever else might come along, decide that human rights violations take place only in other parts of the world, especially when it is Eastern Europe or Latin America or such places. So you're going to Panama to deal with human rights, and you go elsewhere to deal with human rights, and you condemn the Soviet Union and God knows who else because of their human rights record. And yet, the fundamental human right of black people to be able to walk the streets, go about their lawful business without fear of being maimed or killed for no other reason than that they're black, is one that Mrs. Margaret Thatcher has not yet heard of. Traditional communities are displaced by the United States government all over the world as they commandeer their territory to establish military bases, nuclear testing areas, or the stockpiling of weapons to support their role in policing the world. An estimated 40,000 children die each day across the world from malnutrition and disease. In the United States itself, poverty, disease, and an implosion of violence amongst the poor and dispossessed lead to a high fatality rate and a massive overrepresentation of black, Hispanic, and white working class people in prisons and particularly on death row. Yet, the concept of economic refugees, that is, people fleeing starvation and hunger in their own countries and seeking to sell their labor or stay alive in more wealthy countries, is one which most European states, no less than the United States, consider socially, economically, and politically unacceptable. Even refugees and asylum seekers fleeing persecution and political repression find a level of hostility, racism, and xenophobia in European countries which they do not readily associate with so-called liberal democratic societies espousing liberty, equality, and fraternity. It seems to me then that in the context of our existence as people of the diaspora in continental Europe, there are a range of demands that we need to be making, and I just end by stating, without any discussion of them, what these are. Let me just find this text. It seems to me that we need to be calling for the status of residence to be given to all those people who reside in those countries for the purpose of work. And when, as they inevitably will, they offend, the business of applying the criminal law and punishing them through fines or jail sentences or whatever should not be accompanied by their immediate deportation on serving those sentences as a double penalty for being black and daring to offend within those European states. that all groups within the population be empowered to participate in the political and democratic process, regardless of length of residence as workers in those states. That all groups within the society be afforded the right to housing, health services, schooling and education, employment and unemployment benefits, and other social welfare benefits that apply to the rest of the population. That all migrant and foreign workers receive job protection and other workers' rights, including the right to join and exercise their interests within trade unions that obtain within the society as a whole. That no restrictions be placed on the right of asylum seekers to seek asylum in the member countries of the European Community. That the practice, unofficially sanctioned and otherwise, of importing illegal workers from the African continent and elsewhere to be used as cheap, captive labor be outlawed by the European Courts of Justice. That the European courts render illegal and a violation of human rights the practice by which EEC member states give financial or other inducements to so-called donor countries to reclaim the nationals. The Turkish government is being paid by the German government to take back Turks living in Germany, regardless of how long they've lived there and how many children have been born there to them. That the national and international media and the silence on the systematic and murderous persecution and human rights violations meted out to black people, migrants, foreigners, or aliens in those European Community countries, and acknowledge the resurgence of fascism and of barbarism in Europe. My friends, I do not believe that we can possibly come to a point in which we discuss Malcolm X and our struggle for human liberation without an understanding of those wider struggles and the importance that they play in how we act, given what is actually taking place in the international sphere at this precise historical conjuncture. Thank you.